and Environment Committee, and we're continuing a public hearing on the biofuels bill, House Bill 2210.
And the House Revenue Committee is in session, sitting jointly with the Committee on Energy and the Environment for an information meeting on the same matter. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, just a reminder that on Monday, January 29th, this committee over here, the Committee on Energy and Environment, will be kicked out of the revenues room, and we will be meeting in our new hearing room C, and we will hear additional testimony on the biofuels bills, followed by public hearings on the Business Energy Tax Credit House Bill 2211 and the Residential Energy Tax Credit that is House Bill 2212. The House Revenue Committee will not be joining us for those joint hearings, but they will have their regularly scheduled meeting here in this room. Chair Barnhart, do you have anything to add?
Nope. I think you said it all.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I want to thank everybody for coming again today. Some of you are back again, and then for those new folks, if you haven't already signed up, if you plan to testify, is there still a sheet over there?
Yes, there is.
Okay, or there will be soon. If you could sign up at the sheet at the door. And we will also ask if you have handouts, could you please give it to the committee administrator, and then when you come forward to speak, and they will go ahead and distribute that to the members of the dais. Just a reminder, if you have a cell phone, pager, or BlackBerry on, if you could please shut that off because it interferes with our audio equipment here, and that includes people at the dais. I would also like to point out to the committee that Representative Brian Boquist, who is unable to attend today, he has submitted written testimony in support of the bill, and that is in front of you in the dais. I'm not going to read that, but just wanted to make sure that you know, and that will be part of the record. So with that, we will get started. First, I want to see if there's any legislators present. I don't see any who, besides Mr. Broquist, who we have on paper. And then I would like to call up, let's see, we have somebody who's traveled over 100 miles that is not on our panel, and that is Dan Davis from Jackson County. So I would like to have Dan, are you in the audience here? No? Okay, well, maybe he'll come back. So we will start then with our first panel. That is, and I will ask all of you to come up to the witness stand here, please. And we'll have about 5 minutes each, and then we'll leave some time for questions after the panel has made the presentation. First, we have Commissioner Randy Leonard from the – oh, I'm sorry. Well, first, we're going to hear from the Department of Agriculture, Brent Searle, who is going to address some of the questions that were raised during our hearing last time, and then we'll bring up the full panel. I apologize, Brent. I didn't see you sitting there. Brent is with the Department of Agriculture, and I had asked – them to specifically address questions that Representative Witt had raised regarding the agricultural control districts and the research that's being done at OSU in regards to growing of brassica, which is a feedstock for biofuels. Okay. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Gingfelder and Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is Brent Searle, Special Assistant to Director Koba. She sends her regards and regrets. She had a prayer commitment today. She'll be back Monday to pick up any pieces we don't get today. First, let me, again, on behalf of the department, commend all the effort that went into the bill. Department has been involved in a lot of those discussions, and we do feel this is a good start and framework for helping the agriculture industry in Oregon. I think it's worth noting that as we talk about this topic, it's a discussion about changing a lot of things in agriculture, the way natural resources are used, the products that come from those, and that speaks to a lot of unanswered questions, research that needs to be done, crop trials, production methods, harvesting, equipment, storage, handling, processing. All these things are new areas that we're getting into as an industry in agriculture. One of the things that I was asked to give you kind of a broad picture of on page 2 here is farmland use in the state. So you'll see there these numbers are from the 2000 Census of Agriculture. We have about 17 million acres of agriculture land or land in agriculture use in the state. That's about 28% of the land mass. I've divided that into what I call working lands and non-working lands. So the top categories there, about 15.8 million of working lands, of which about 5 million is harvested crop land. And this is the category we're going to talk about in a little more detail in terms of potential feedstock acreage. A little over 2 million acres of woodlands, significant acres of this would be open range land. And then you can see the non-working lands there in conservation and other uses. So if you'll flip with me to page 7, we'll go into a little more detail on crop breakdown and some production potential. This is chart 1, page 7. You will see the main categories of crops here, and the big acreages that jump at you are hay, wheat, grass seed, and some other grains there. And those are probably the acreages that we're really talking about for rotational crops here. And I'll talk a little bit later briefly about biomass or feedstocks for ethanol. That's a ways off. So really right now, we're talking about canola, and I'll mention reasons for that later. But if we consider canola and you talk about optimistic, and that is 1 in 4 year rotation, that's the limit on canola. You don't plant it year after year, or 2 in 5 years in some areas. The uppermost potential there is about 800,000 acres or 16% of our harvested crop land, which would convert somewhere around 140 million gallons of biodiesel. A more realistic and probably still optimistic estimate on some of those acreages, you'll see, add up to about 300,000 acres, working up gradually to that about 6% of our harvested cropland, which potentially is around 50 million acres, 50 million gallons of biodiesel. Now, to put that in context, I think this year, what was planted last fall and coming into this year in terms of canola, is probably in the 4,000 to 5,000 acres total in Oregon right now. And I think we'll have more go in this fall. But that gives you a little bit of the context, and we're just starting into this. It's going to take us a while. There's a lot of issues I'll briefly touch on here to deal with this. If you flip the page there to chart 2.
What page are you on?
The next page, page 8. Okay. Again, just put this in context of economics, and I put some examples there, comparison with wheat, perennial ryegrass, and canola. And partly what's going to drive this is grower alternatives and what are the prices of those alternatives. And if we want to engender or encourage feedstock in this state, we have to, through the process you're engaged in, create incentives that make these feedstocks, canola in particular, or other things may come about, economic incentives to growers to do that. So the yields you see there for wheat are east side. These are kind of poor, medium, and good years under dry land conditions. If we look at $3.50 or $5 bushel wheat, in that range, you can see the gross receipts there. Perennial ryegrass, again, this would be in western Oregon here, of course, in the valley, kind of south valley to north valley, low to high yields, 60 cent a pound, and you can see the gross receipt range there. And canola, yield range is priced at 14 cents, which is about where the market is now. If you look at North Dakota and Canada, that's where the primary markets are. They're right in the 13, 14 cent range and gross receipts. So most growers, because this is a new crop, it's a learning experience, aren't going to jump at this unless there's something to address the risks involved. And in addition to that, the rotational benefits that come from that. The chart to the right there, you can see that acreage does follow price. In the last decade or so, you can see when the price has been above 10 cents to 14 cents, the production went up. And when it fell below that, the production went clear down to zero almost. And it's headed back up now, but there's some significant challenges here we'll talk about. So going back now to page 3 in my testimony. Sorry to jump around. It's a challenge to fit all the numbers in here. Addressing the research that's going on, the emergency board provided some funding through the department in concert with Oregon State University, and this is the first year of this research. We have some trials, plot trials in the Willamette Valley for canola and alternatives. These were all planted last fall. We'll have 1 year of research as these crops are analyzed as they come in. The next chart you see there, this is from western Montana, but these yields are pretty similar through the Pacific Northwest. And as you look at those in both dry land and irrigated conditions, you'll see that winter canola, which we are dealing with here in Oregon, it's like fall planted wheat, consistently is the higher yielding. It also is a higher oil content than all of these other crops in general, and those are critical economic issues for growers and processors. You got to have high yields and high oil content. So again, that goes back to why canola. That's why canola. It's pretty evident right there. Right now, off the shelf crop, this is the one we're dealing with. So going on to page four, the challenge with canola, it's a Nebraska family of crops. It has the potential to cross-pollinate with other crops to grow in the Willamette Valley and some other areas of the state. And some of those other crops, vegetable seeds, are very high value per acre. And canola can become a weed, can cross-pollinate, share diseases. So we've got a coexistence issue going on with canola with other crops. But keep in mind the scale here. These special vegetable seeds, total acreage, cross-pollination-wise, is probably 2,000 to 3,000 acres. All of these, the other ones included, are about 14,000. The clover seeds also have concerns about weediness from canola, so there's another 20,000 acres. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 acres in the Willamette Valley here. Grass seed, which is desperate for a rotation crop, trying to get we're overproduction in many of the grass varieties. Looking for rotation, a canola would help them control their weeds because they can then spray for grasses and clean them up. 500,000 acres in the Willamette Valley. So the scale is significantly different, and that's part of the concern of the specialty growers is you get a large reservoir of canola, and it presents some challenges there. So that's the purpose of the research through OSU, is trying to help the department determine what is the level of threat, where do we draw the boundaries, what other crops are potential alternatives so we don't have this conflict. But I think it's worth emphasizing that for the department to step in and create a district like this and prohibit growers from determining what they want to plant on their own private property is a big intervention on the part of government. And so we take this very seriously on both sides of this issue, and we're working through it with the growers. In general, it's not a new issue. Coexistence has existed forever since farming has started. And so we're trying to help them work through these issues. Some of the other possible oil seed crops that are being looked at are flax, camelina, safflower, and sunflower. And we're looking at how those overwinter, how they'll yield, what the threats are to the other crops, and so forth. OSU has a website up on this. It's listed there in the testimony, and they're doing updates. Really, you need 2 or 3 years of research like this to get good results. The rule on our canola area is up for review at the end of 2007, so we're going to get into this discussion again, hopefully have some answers, but I think longer-term research is also going to be needed.
Brent, in the interest of time, since we have a lot of people sitting behind you who also would like to come up, I was going to see if you could address the cellulose, just talk about the cellulosic ethanol, and then I'm going to bring up the person, Dan Davis, who is here, and then we'll have some questions from the panel.
Very briefly, you'll see on page 5 there, I think this is still a couple years away in terms of potential for growers. Initially, it's going to be grass straw and wheat straw. On the very last page of my testimony is a letter that was sent from one of the companies who is very interested in annual ryegrass in the Willamette Valley here. California company, Calusa Biomass, and you can get an idea of their project specifics there. So
great. I would like, if I can call Mr. Davis up to the stand? Brent, do you want to? You could stay there because they're going to have questions. And I wanted to thank you, by the way, Brent, because the Department of Agriculture has been really helpful, colleagues. I first learned about this issue with the concern about cross-pollinization about 2 years ago when I attended a Farm Bureau meeting, and about 150 farmers showed up and were very concerned, and I wanted to make sure that their concerns were addressed. And so I appreciate the work the department has been doing to try to address these concerns, and I'm sure by working together we'll be able to do that. So thank you, and I'm sorry we called you up and missed you before.
Madam Chairman, thank you. My name is Dan Davis. I'm from Jacksonville, and I'm president of Sun Biofuels. For the record, I think it was Hubert Humphrey that said, always go to the bathroom first and then speak. So.
It's okay. It happens to the best of us.
I'm here today to talk about the importance and the urgency of developing biofuels in Oregon, especially biodiesel. And I brought this. I accidentally took the wrong bottle out of my car. And what this is bad biodiesel. So this is kind of an example of what a lot of people are making in their garages and in their backyards, and we've made some of it too. Good biodiesel is nice and clear. It's an excellent, outstanding fuel. It's actually better than petroleum diesel or petrodiesel because it has better lubricity. It's better on the fuel system. It's better on fuel pumps. It burns significantly cleaner. Federal government figures say 78% less carbon dioxide emissions from biodiesel versus petrodiesel. So that's a significant impact on global warming. And other pollutants are significantly less as well. CO, carbon monoxide, is 50%. Sulfur dioxide, it doesn't exist, unless there's a contaminant in the biodiesel. There's no natural sulfur in biodiesel. It's compatible with every aspect of petrodiesel production and distribution. You can use the same tanks, you can use the same pumps, pipelines, and it goes in the same fuel tank with a diesel truck or car without any modification. So it's really very compatible with existing handling and distribution systems. And on top of that, and I don't need to belabor this, is the potential for a lot of increased farm production in the state of Oregon. That's what we're hoping to see, and I'm really glad to see some of this work that's been done. What I'd like to do is ask the committee, and I know you have a bill that you're specifically addressing, but I know what we would like to see as business people is to encourage farming and pressing of canola to oil. And that's obviously one of the things you're addressing. I'd like to see some way to encourage the investigation of use of algae, which has a very high yield of oil, of good quality oil. I don't know exactly, not being an agriculture expert, but I understand that you can get 2 to 4 crops a year in our climate. So it would be a very high yield source of oil. Obviously, I'd like to see you encourage manufacturing, and I think part of the bill does address the needs of manufacturers. I'd like to suggest something that I don't see in the bill, and or at least the version I've read, is consideration of a reduction in the road tax for biodiesel. Some rough calculations on my part. I don't have the exact consumption of diesel in the state of Oregon, but I understand it's about 500 million gallons a year, and that coincides with several figures I've gotten. If the road tax on biodiesel was reduced by 10 cents a gallon, and the blend of biodiesel to diesel was B2, 2% biodiesel, that would cost the state about $1.5 million a year. but it would make a significant difference in the attractiveness of biodiesel to the average consumer, and would equalize the price nicely.
Mr. Davis, I just want to quickly address the bills that I had last session. That was a joint package. We looked at doing that, and committee members, just so you know, at trying to have a credit for the gas tax, and we were told that the constitutional there were some constitutionality issues. So I just want to alert for the members, that's why we have the consumer sort of rebate portion that's in the bill now, and to address, provide an incentive, that's for B99, just to make sure folks know, and that's capped at $200. But that was to provide an extra incentive, because we did initially try to do that through the gas tax. So it's a great idea. We just had some implementation problems with that.
Yeah, and perhaps that could be a longer-term consideration. But at any rate, what we'd like to see as business people, and speaking for myself, I can't speak for all business people, obviously, but is good, solid government cooperation. And I believe we're getting that now this session. And we'll see more of that. And it's not because we can't make it on our own, because we can. But the urgency of the potential disasters of climate change dictate quick action, in my view. To encourage a product that can not only make a huge improvement in the relative environmental impacts, but also Oregon's economy. So it's just the right thing to do from an economic, social, and environmental standpoint. So thank you for listening.
Well, thank you so much for coming up here. I have to ask, did you use biodiesel on your way up here?
I wish I had, but I got such a great offer on my diesel truck that I sold it. But I did use it for a year very successfully. Cold weather, I burned B50 in one tank and B100 in the other tank, and if it got below 40 degrees, I'd have to start up on the B50 tank until such time it warmed up over 40. But that's easily addressed. Like I said, B50 blend worked fine.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming all the way up here. I wanted to see if there was any questions from any of the committee members before we move on to the next panel.
I do have a quick question.
Representative.
Yeah, we heard from the Farm Bureau on Wednesday that in their testimony that with current commodity prices, Eastern Oregon producers will earn $20 to $40 less per acre growing canola over wheat. That seems perhaps a little inconsistent with the numbers that you gave, even if you take the high number for canola and then the low number for wheat. Will you try to address that discrepancy?
Just a reminder to folks, that buzzing sound is somebody's cell phone or BlackBerry, and we have problems recording if that isn't shut off. So just a friendly reminder.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, I think, again, it depends on the year, the yield, the price. All these things are variables, and the assumptions, and these are a snapshot in time. So that could change. I think the price of canola, it depends on which price you use. I mean, I think there's prices of 12 cents out there. The price I have in here is the data cash price out of North Dakota right now, which is the primary market for canola in the United States. So I think the point that the Farm Bureau made was wheat prices are high right now, and so that's discouraging planting of canola over there, and the incentives need to take that into account, was their point.
Thank you.
Can I comment
Certainly.
On that? Is that an oil price, or is that a
per price? Pound of seed.
Seed, okay. Because the oil prices are around 28 cents a pound to 30 cents a pound right now.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Any other questions? Okay. And I please encourage you, if you have additional questions for the Department of Agriculture, because these are somewhat complicated concepts here, please don't hesitate to call them and address certain issues. The other challenge right now is that the markets are fluctuating. It's good. We'd like to see these prices going up for farmers, but we also want to make sure that we're able to provide, sort of equal, a rate that is encouraging farmers to grow these feedstocks. The other, as was mentioned by Brent Searle, is that this is an important rotational crop for grass seed growers, so that's another benefit there. So now I will call up the next panel, which is Commissioner Randy Leonard from the City of Portland. who some of you may recognize as a former member of this body, Kent Madison from Madison Farms. I guess this is going to be a pretty crowded group if we have everybody up here. So Scott Winkle from the League of Oregon Cities. And then we'll call up the other two right afterwards. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee, my name is Randy Leonard. I'm a Portland City Commissioner serving on the Portland City Council. Thank you for asking me to be here today. I'm happy to support House Bill 2210 and the Portland Renewable Fuel Standard and give testimony to both of those issues today. I understand that some members at the last meeting had some questions about Portland's standard and whether or not they were complementary to the statewide effort, and I certainly want to address those issues. But before I do, I would like to talk briefly about a visit that I made this past fall to Eastern Oregon to talk with farmers such as Kent Madison sitting on my left and local officials about their interest in biofuels. My first stop, in fact, was at Madison's Farms in Echo, Oregon, and actually it was the second time that I had the pleasure of visiting Kent Madison at his farm. The first time was as a member of this body, and then Representative Jensen, who was chairing a committee I was fortunate enough to serve on with him, took a number of us from the House to Kent Madison's farm and a number of other site visits through Eastern Oregon for a two-day tour. It remains to be, and something I actually reminded Ken about, one of the highlights of my 10 years that I served here in the Oregon legislature. It was a fascinating trip. And if there's any chance for Bob, you can influence the chairs to do that trip again. I think that would be I'm sure everybody had the same impression I did. Kent is a true innovator with renewable fuels and has made renewable energy equate with smart business in managing his farm. And I'm going to let Kent tell you more about his operations, but I would like to share what I've learned meeting with Kent, the Pendleton Grain Growers Association, the Mayor of Pendleton, and a number of other officials from Eastern Oregon. I learned the best way to bridge the divide between urban and rural communities is through economic development. Our success is interdependent. We discussed how Portland's needs for biodiesel could be met by farmers in Eastern Oregon and other parts of the state. The city alone uses more than 300,000 gallons of biodiesel annually, and we expect this to increase in coming years. And I'm just talking about our city fleet. Our Water Bureau diesel trucks are the largest fleet in the United States that runs on B99, while other diesel trucks in the city's fleet run on an average of B20. And by the way, we all are proud to say that we buy, as a city, all of our diesel from Sequential Fuels, the only Oregon-based biodiesel producer. I also learned by listening to the farmers and the grain experts that certain feedstocks are better equipped for use in Oregon's climate due to their low gel points, which is an important issue that this committee needs to discuss. That is why we amended the ordinance to specify that these feedstocks, which can be grown in Oregon, must be used to satisfy 50% of the ordinance's requirements once the state production reaches a certain threshold amount. One of these experts, Don Wysocki from OSU, testified in support of this amendment before the Portland City Council and explained the scientific basis for the city specifying what kind of feedstock can be used to meet our requirement. The Portland RFS, which will go into effect this coming summer, will require all diesel sold within the city limits to contain at least 5% biodiesel, and gasoline must have 10% ethanol. This standard is expected to create a reliable demand for over 4 million gallons of biodiesel and 16 million gallons of ethanol, giving some market certainty for the development of large-scale Oregon-based biofuel production facilities. For more on the ordinance, please see the one-page summary that I've had passed out to each of you. I want to be sure to address the committee's questions from Wednesday about how the Portland RFS will work with the proposed state RFS. The most important issue for fuel distributors is whether they have access to the necessary infrastructure to store, manage, and blend the pure biodiesel product. Nearly all of the fuel terminals and racks in Portland have already installed this infrastructure or are working on plans to do so in time to meet the July 1st deadline. When this infrastructure is in place, fuel distributors can adjust the delivery blends accordingly to send either B99 or B20 or B5 or any other mixture they want right from the fuel dock. Also, when the regional production of feedstock reaches 15 million gallons annually, both Portland and the state will be at a B5 standard. Furthermore, to prepare for the implementation of the Portland RFS, the city has been working very closely with the petroleum, biodiesel, ethanol, and trucking industries, as well as representatives from retailers, fuel distributors, and interested stakeholders. We have worked with the Oregon Department of Agriculture to tailor the city's regulation to follow existing state practices wherever possible. The work group is currently addressing issues such as quality testing and reporting practices and is advising the city on its rulemaking process. The lessons learned from this process and the city's implementation will help lay the groundwork for the state's RFS. The last point that I would like to address is that Portland is also offering financial incentives to boost production and distribution of biofuels. As a complement to the RFS, the city has committed $750,000 to help transform Portland's transportation fuels market, including two grant programs that offer financial incentives to make biofuels more readily available throughout Portland. These grants can be used to reduce upfront costs to install or convert fueling equipment. The money can be used for tanks and pumps to handle high blends of biofuels. The grant program will also support non-infrastructure related projects, including the development of Oregon-grown feedstock supply chains. These incentives demonstrate that Portland is willing to make major investment and help industry and farmers make the investment to support the development of a renewable fuels market. In conclusion, I am very supportive of this bill and commend the chairs and the committees for taking up this issue of great importance to the whole state and, I would argue, to the whole nation. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. And first we're going to hear from the rest of the panel, and then I'm sure there'll be some questions for you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And Mr. Madison?
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you, Chair Dinkfeller and Chair Barnhart. Sorry about that. I don't speak in front of you folks very often. I especially want to recognize Representative Jensen and Smith, who are representatives from my district, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of you. I got this bill yesterday and had a chance to read through it. I was down in Corvallis at another meeting giving a presentation about biodiesel, and so I had the opportunity to speak to you.
And excuse me, for the record, can you please state your name and address?
Sorry, yeah. Yes, Kent Madison, 29299 Madison Road, Echo, Oregon.
Thank you.
After reading through the bill, there is a few things that I would like to comment about, and the first one is on, it's going to be Section 6, line 37 on page 4, where you have a $1 per million BTU incentive. That works out to be about one-half of 1 cent on the production of canola, and that is basically nothing from a production standpoint. And I understand that you're talking about maybe going to the $8 number, which would be 4 cents, and that's a much more reasonable number, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, and I just want to let you know that there will be some amendments addressing that.
Okay. The other comment that I had is on page 6, line 21. I see that there's no blank or no number put in the blank for the calendar year. The department may not serve by more than blank. And I assume there's going to be a number there.
Look at that
time.
Side of the dais, because that's their job.
We'll fix that when it comes to revenue.
Part of the reason that the limit is a problem is the production of canola is going to be probably produced on high volume, large farms. So the limits could be a problem for us as far as if we bump up against the limit, then there's only going to be so many acres that we would plant because that's what the limit would, the incentive on that limit would be. One other comment, I think that was it I had for this, was on page 8 on section 15, you talk about the trigger point that starts the process. It says when the production of biodiesel in the state from sources of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana reach a level of 5 million gallons. I believe we'll be at that level probably within this next year, possibly even this fall during our harvest cycle, which is a good thing. But what I see is happening, or what I see happening as you go down to line 32, 33, and 34 is we will create the product to be made into biodiesel, but it doesn't say that you have to buy it. You can then go buy your biodiesel. You can buy soy oil out of the Midwest to come in to make the biodiesel out of. And so we go out there and raise canola to produce the crop to get us to the 5 million gallon number, and all of a sudden the industry will probably buy the cheaper oil, and soy oil is the cheaper oil. Remember that soy oil is a byproduct of the soy meal process, where canola oil is the main product, or canola oil is a main product out of the canola process. So that part kind of concerns me. I'm not sure how we can address that from a legal standpoint, but I can see us not being able to compete with other oils, especially if you allow palm oil to be in part of the renewable fuel standard. And that's back to what Commissioner Leonard talked about when we had the conversation with him about the quality of fuel. We as canola growers and biodiesel producers that are producing biodiesel from canola, which is the highest quality feedstock, we're concerned that the industry uses poor quality feedstocks because they're cheaper, and those poor quality feedstocks end up in the engines of our citizens, and we end up getting a bad name for canola-based biodiesel. So I would really like to see an actual branding of the type of fuel that's being used. So I would like to see a CB number, so for canola biodiesel, or an SB for soy biodiesel, or a PB for palm biodiesel. That way the consumer can see when he's buying fuel at that particular tank. Now, I don't know the logistics of how that would handle in the distribution system, but my concern is somebody fills up a palm-based biodiesel, drives over the mountain and freezes up, and then cusses biodiesel and cusses you guys in particular because you forced it in their tanks. So I would highly recommend that you try the best quality product. Other than that, the bill itself is a very good bill. I think anything that we can do as a society to wean ourselves off of petroleum diesel and petroleum fuels is a good thing. It's great for our economy. It allows us to recirculate those dollars that are currently leaving our state because we have no oil wells and we have no refineries. At least those dollars are now being recirculated back into the ag economy, and it has a tremendous benefit back into that. So I'm very supportive of what you're doing. We do have a canola crushing facility that's operational now, where we crush our own canola and manufacture our own biodiesel, and we sell raw oil to Sequential also, and Sequential sells that oil as a branded product in their Eugene retail station as Oregon-grown, Oregon-processed biodiesel. So we're working with Randy close on that too, to continue to keep that Oregon-grown logo in place.
Thank you so much for your comments, and we will certainly be in touch with you as we work with the Department of Energy and Department of Agriculture to address those. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kingfelder, Chair Barnhart. I'm Scott Winkles with the League of Oregon Cities. Our League of Oregon Cities is very appreciative of this opportunity to weigh in on this piece of legislation. We participated actively in discussions in the interim, and look forward to pushing to a bill that works for local governments, consumers, the state as a whole, and industry. The bill offers three distinct benefits for cities that I'd like to outline today. First and foremost, as large consumers of petroleum, we see market-based incentives for the passage of HB 2010. Secondly, this bill assists with economic development in areas of the state that desperately need it. And lastly, the bill helps cities address their concerns with waste issues by recognizing that waste as having value as a fuel source. Our first point on the market benefits. As large consumers of fuel products, cities are concerned by trends and projections in the oil market. When oil hit $72 a barrel in April of 2006, that price actually exceeded the Energy Information Agency's high-end forecast for the year 2019. I point this out in order to demonstrate the extreme volatility and unpredictability of this commodity. Additionally, according to the International Monetary Fund and other sources, global oil demand is fast approaching 85 million barrels a day. In the same report, they indicate that the oil refinery capacity is estimated at approximately 86 million barrels a day. With market conditions such as these, it is difficult, if not impossible, for cities to effectively estimate their fuel costs. By creating incentives for biofuel production and structuring the standard, the way it's described in the bill. Cities see a likelihood that this bill will inject a stabilizing factor into local fuel markets and offer price benefits to large consumers such as cities. Also, the benefits HB 2010 has in the area of economic development are significant. Provisions in the bill that offer incentives for the collection and production of biomass feedstocks portends job creations in parts of the state still reeling from decline of the timber industry. The LOC is working with the Department of Energy, the Governor's Office, and our industry partners on a package of amendments that will make these incentives fiscally responsible and effective for industry. HB 2010 also addresses the issue of waste streams. The LOC has been working diligently with principals of Polaris Energy to bring the first wastewater biosolids energy project in the country to Oregon. This technology would use wastewater biosolid, essentially sludge, as a fuel source. This project represents a $30 million private investment in renewable energy for the state. And it's carbon neutral, and it also helps us address our problem of what to do with solid waste streams. So we see this as a significant benefit to our members. In conclusion, I'd just like to simply say that the League of Oregon Cities is pleased to be part of crafting HB 2010 and look forward to passage of a bill that meets the needs of consumers, industry, local governments, and the state.
Thank you. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And we will now take questions for the panel. I'll start over on this side for once. They've answered all your questions. Representative Wick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment for Commissioner Leonard. Randy, it's great to see you building bridges between rural and urban Oregon. We continue to follow your career, and it's good to see you back here.
Thank you very much, Representative Wick. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Leonard, thank you very much for coming down today. I appreciate your time and enjoyed getting to visit with you earlier today as well on this topic.
I appreciate that.
For the panel, just whoever would be interested in comment on this, a couple things that are of interest to me. One is, coming from Central Oregon, temperatures are colder, and I'm concerned about this gel point question. I'm kind of getting some mixed signals. I asked some folks about it at the hearing on Wednesday, and then we discussed it this morning. So I'm just curious if you could get a little more clarification on that, please.
If I could just hit the high points, then it can give you much more detail. But from our perspective, and this is an issue that's been raised with some with respect to the Commerce Clause, whether or not it's appropriate to have applied our ordinance in such a narrow way so that it ends up that regionally farmers in Eastern Oregon and Washington benefit more than others. But it was on this issue of gel point. We are legitimately, as you should be, very concerned that, as Kent said, somebody put a product in their fuel tank, end up in a cold climate, and blame biodiesel in general, when the truth is there are different grades of agriculture products that produce various kinds of biodiesel. Palm oil gels at around 50 degrees. Soybean oil somewhere in the 28 degree, 30 degree range. Canola-based biodiesel less than zero Fahrenheit. And so from a public policy point of view, we, of course, want to make sure that we're getting the grade of biodiesel that is best suited for a variety of temperatures and doesn't end up causing people's gas lines to basically cake up with what is Crisco, what looks like Crisco. And so that's kind of the general basis, but Kent has a lot more detail.
Totally correct on that, yeah. That's the concern that we had when they originally were going to allow palm oil. Yeah, in particular, I'm not anti-palm oil, don't get me wrong, but I'm anti-poor fuel. And that was my concern with that. So I think that somehow that does need to be addressed in one fashion or another, whether it's just through public awareness, so the public knows that if they want to buy a cheaper palm biodiesel, they can do so, but they, it's kind of like buy it with caution, you might say, or you can buy the more expensive canola. And really those commodities, even on the market, are different prices because they have a different value.
And I would urge you to consider the kind of language we adopted in our ordinance, which we flush with the city attorney's office and other, that ends up indirectly benefiting Oregon farmers for sure, but not in an unfair way. I mean, anybody can compete based on the kind of product they have to supply it to meet our 5% demand, but it just so happens it benefits Oregon farmers, and we're happy about that.
Second question.
Follow-up, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second question deals with the matter of preemption, and, you know, I'd like to get your thoughts and comments about, you know, what's the future of the Portland ordinance if we adopt the statewide standard? What about preempting other local governments from doing likewise down the road?
Well, if I again briefly address that. That was actually this issue of fuel and how we propel our vehicles and power our industry is kind of what propelled us to develop this ordinance. I think there's a bipartisan agreement throughout the United States today between elected officials and citizens that much of our foreign policy is directed because of the foreign oil producing countries' demands on us, that we treat countries different, sometimes to our detriment, who happen to be oil suppliers than those that don't. So that's kind of a global reason why we went ahead with this. But I think more importantly, we should be talking about who can raise the bar the fastest and supply the greatest amount of alternative fuels for vehicles and industry the quickest and the best, not try to get it down as low as possible. But if we have a standard that's 5%, that isn't the only folks that lose from that is the petroleum industry. Farmers win, Americans win, we all win. We create economic development in our communities, whereas those dollars used to go to Houston or some foreign country. But as Kent said, all those dollars stay local. So I would hope that you would consider matching what Portland did and creating incentives to get other cities to do that and even more to really create a powerful message that we really are intending to reduce our reliance on foreign oil, which was a major motivator for me in developing this ordinance.
Vice Chair Dingfelder, Chair Dingfelder, Chair Barnhart, and Vice Chair Burley. It's the position of the league. This is a local control issue. I mean, this is something that we feel that Portland is well within their rights to determine their own fuel standard. And moreover, the other league members have been involved in this process, and they've done an excellent job in bringing the rural parts of the state in. So we don't view HB 2010 or the Portland RFS as mutually exclusive at all. And in fact, I think it could be said that they're complementary.
Did you want to add something?
From our standpoint, from a grower standpoint, it was probably easier to help Portland push the renewable fuel standard through their process. And no offense to your guys' process, because you guys weren't too lucky 2 years ago getting it through. So it was nice to have Randy show up at my doorstep and say, we want to do this because we want to link that rural-urban divide, and that we could supply something to him. In return, he could supply us something green back. So that was a very nice incentive. the other question about the quality of fuel is when the EPA instigated the ultra-low sulfur demand on fuel, they took a lot of the lubricity out of it. So biodiesel, I think, will actually have a benefit to the petroleum industry because it will supply lubricity back into the fuel systems that's currently either being put back in as some kind of additive. And we actually do. I ran biodiesel in my pickup. I ran biodiesel in my tractors and combines and things like that. And we actually get better performance and better gas mileage out of them than we did prior to that. And we're not real sure why, because supposedly there's less BTUs per gallon of biodiesel than there is gallon of petroleum diesel, but we think it's just efficiencies and lubricity that make the difference. And they are quieter also. A vehicle run on biodiesel is actually a quieter engine. So from a public mass transit standpoint, you may find your buses to be a little quieter.
And Kent, just a quick follow-up on your comment about lubricity. What would be the alternative lubricity agent that would typically be used then?
I'm not sure what they're running into.
I guess we'll ask the petroleum industry when they come up. All right, thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, Representative Barnhart, and then we'll go to Representative Smith.
Thank you. I'm back on this poor quality because it won't pour question. And it's I think I'm wanting to ask a couple of kind of technical sorts of things. I wonder if it's possible to adopt a requirement that is based on the gel point of the fuel rather than on the content. And also, I guess as a piece of that, I wonder if you mix different of these oils, if they stay mixed, and that affects the gel point. If it doesn't, then of course it doesn't do you any good to mix them. And I guess my third point is really just a comment. There are very few days in Oregon, any place in Oregon, except perhaps on the coast, and probably not even there, where it doesn't get below 50 degrees sometime during the day or at night, even in the middle of the summer. So palm oil would have a very detrimental effect on diesel operations here. Can anybody answer those questions?
I think on the palm oil issue, it depends on the blend. If you run it like B2, that may be a lot less of a problem than if it was running B5 or B10 or B20. But I'm not familiar with palm oil because I don't use it, and I'm familiar with canola oil because that's what I produce. And I don't know about the blending of different blends of oil together, other than the waste oil industry, which is what sequential built their industry off of, is a mixture of multiple different oil sources that they do make biodiesel out of, and their biodiesel then would have a gel point, kind of a blended gel point, you might say, of whatever their feedstocks are. But it's kind of interesting that there is no gel point in the biodiesel ASTM standard, and the biodiesel ASTM standard was established by the soybean board, and the soybean board obviously has a higher gel point than the canola board. If the canola board established the biodiesel standard, it probably would have a gel point because it's the best quality product.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're actually, Representative Barnhart, approaching this exactly the way I was. We chose to identify the plant families, Brassica, Camelina, Phalaenopsis, that have lower gel points, but I think we could have got there the same way that you're describing by having a gel point standard. The effect would be the same, in my opinion, that you end up finding that it just so happens geographically, and because of our climate, it benefits Oregon farmers a lot because they are the only ones that can grow in any amount of quantity the kinds of crops that yield this high quality.
Mr. Davis in the back has his hand up. If you want to quickly, if you can address this, but you have to come up to the podium so you can be on the record, please. And then we'll get to your questions, gentlemen.
Thanks. We've had a lot of experience with gelling.
For the record, can you just say your name again for the
Dan
folks
Davis
listening?
From Jacksonville, Oregon. Do you need the address? Back east, where I spent a lot of my business career, they do have to blend diesel, petroleum diesel, because of the gel point of petroleum diesel. So in the wintertime, they're not allowed to sell diesel that's not blended usually with kerosene, which brings down the gel point. And I'd like to also say there's a lot more quality problems at issue with biodiesel that aren't really a gel point. Gel point, once it warms up, it goes back to liquid and it's fine. It doesn't cause a problem, except it's a temporary problem, I should say. Palm oil, it has other environmental problems in that they're cutting vast swashes of rainforest in tropical climates to plant palm for the purpose of palm oil. So we don't want to see palm oil at all for that reason. And we're very supportive of canola, and we are the second biodiesel producer in the state. We're just getting started, but we will be there. So did I address your quality problems with gelling?
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we have a couple more questions, and then we're going to move on to the next panel. And Representative Smith and then Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I can't. It's great seeing you. It's great having your wisdom brought down here to the Capitol. Question about the quality of fuel. You raise that issue, and I think that's a valid issue. And last week, college, you heard my concern about mandates on the citizens of Oregon. Would it make sense to have a mandate on producers requiring them to produce a certain quality of biodiesel so that way consumers know that when it is mixed, blended, that they know what they're getting?
Go ahead.
answering that question for me.
I guess I open
as
that
a producer.
Up.
I guess
I mean I ask that to all of us because
I think that they're asking for any of you to respond.
I mean, again, I wouldn't want to be sitting in your seats a year from now if bad fuel is put on the market or fuel that gels up is put on the market. And he is correct stating that the product could gel and then as it warms up it ungels, but we've all been around times when it doesn't warm up for days on end. So if you just don't plan on going anywhere, that's okay, but it's kind of a bad deal otherwise. Now you can, like in my case, my vehicle will park in a garage and it can stay warm enough that it may be okay, but when I go to work and park it outside, and then it gels up and you can't get back home, so you got all those issues associated with it, too.
Just a quick follow-up. First of all, in the bill, everything would have to meet ASTM standards, which are the same standards that have to be met all petroleum in the state. So
there it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right. And then as far as 2 to 5% biodiesel, which is what we're looking at, that doesn't mean we're going to prevent anybody from selling anything higher, but the renewable fuel standard addresses 2 to 5%, 2 and then going on to 5%. So if you would like to comment on any of that as a follow-up.
I think that B2 or B5 is not a problem. I've never heard of anybody having a problem with gelling at that level, unless it's you're talking below zero F, then you very would possibly. We don't have a problem with having standards set by the state for biodiesel. We think it's a good idea, in fact, so that we don't have poor quality biodiesel, which would hurt all of us if consumers start having major problems with our product.
Thank you. That addressed your question. You. Representative Jensen, you had a question?
Kind of quick question for Kent. But before the question, my comment to the committee that we would be delighted to arrange a visit with Kent to the Madison Farms and some of the other things there. If either or both of the two chairs would agree to bring your folks along. Now, I would like to set your minds at ease, members, that contrary to popular myth in the Portland and Willamette Valley, it really isn't an uncharted wilderness. You will find it on the maps, and we do have roads.
We'll bring our GPS units with us, Representative Jensen, just in case we get lost.
Come to the Port of Morrow where they're going to be producing the product.
We'll see if we can arrange that.
But Kent, getting off the biodiesel for a minute and talking about the ethanol, do you have any thoughts on ethanol, since the feedstock for ethanol probably is not going to come from the growers of eastern Oregon? I think, probably corn is the principal feedstock, and I do know that we can produce corn in eastern Oregon, but whether we can produce it in the volume that is needed, maybe another question. So, have you got any thoughts on the ethanol? I know we've been concentrating on diesel.
The increase in the ethanol demand nationwide has driven the corn price up nationwide. So even though we may not sell corn personally to Pacific Ethanol, just the fact those unit trains out of the Midwest are coming into the area is driving the price of corn up, which is a good thing for us too. So we're definitely in support of the ethanol side of it. That will have direct benefits to agriculture in Oregon that do raise corn. And so it's going to help. Without a doubt. But he is right. There's going to be a lot. We can't raise enough corn to meet the ethanol demand.
And I'd also, Representative Jensen, draw to your attention on page 5, the third paragraph that the Department of Agriculture handed out, their explanation about cellulosic ethanol, and we keep hearing that sort of on the cusp of becoming commercially viable, and I think that is what we're looking at as hopefully in the future being able to meet our needs. And we heard from Pacific Ethanol. I know we'll hear from some other folks, and they might be able to address that as well. Any other questions for the panel?
And Madam Chair, I did write down in my own personal diesel-powered vehicle that's fueled with biofuel from Kent's farm.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to, I'm sorry we couldn't fit everybody up at the podium there. Gary Neal, who's the general manager for the Port of Morrow. This is the Eastern Oregon Day here. Brian Dougherty from the Western States Petroleum Alliance. And then I think I will call up Jeff Rouse, who's the alternative fuels manager from Carson Oil Company, will get a little competition going right up here and hopefully can also address some of those questions. Feel free, if you want to address some of the questions that came up, to do that. And then just a reminder for the record, please state your name and organization and address. Absolutely. Okay, so who's ready to go first? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Chair Dan Felder and Chair Barnhart, for the members of the committee. My name is Gary Neal. I'm the general manager of the Port of Morrow, located in Morrow County in Eastern Oregon. I have the fortunate opportunity to be involved in a lot of infrastructure improvements and industrial related activities in the port and the Pacific Ethanol facility that I think you received testimony on Wednesday is being constructed at the port. I actually have some pictures of that being passed around, and so you might be able to see what's going on at the port there. Along with that information, there's a map, an aerial photo that identifies some additional potential facilities that are under works at the port. We are working with other clients with the possibility of four other ethanol production facilities as well. Part of the reason for our location has to do with, as indicated earlier, with the unit train capabilities of bringing the Rocky stuff into Oregon. The New Pacific Mainline intersects with the Columbia River and Interstate 84 at the Port of Morrow, so it brings into a strategic location for transportation options for both the raw product, the finished product for distribution back out, as well as the byproduct opportunities that will have to be taken care of with these large facilities. The current facility under construction, I think is about 42 million gallon a year production facility. Reports obviously interested in a lot of different components of ethanol production and biofuels production, and a lot of it's driven by capital investment opportunities, diversity in our ag base, the opportunity to create some good paying jobs, and so I guess all combination of those what drives our interest in seeing these kind of projects materialize. A lot of these projects are $70 million plus each, 30 to 50 jobs in each facility. We compare them wage-wise to kind of like power plant projects in our region, which are some of the higher-paying jobs that we have in Eastern Oregon. And so we're pretty excited about the synergies that can bring. The finished product is being considered there for distribution either by barge or rail, or if you go through the energy facility siting council process, you can go through a procedure that would allow more than 10% of the finished product to be transported by truck. Otherwise, you cannot do that. You're restricted by the finished product distribution and the energy opportunity to deliver ethanol production into the Northwest. The port is a strategic location. We believe we're in the center of the Northwest. If you look at our map, you'll be able to find that we can go in all directions from our area to Spokane or Montana or into Idaho or over to Seattle or down to Portland or go to 97 in Central Oregon and distribute in all directions. The export opportunities for the byproduct with the strike can be exported to the Pacific Rim countries for feedstock, and so we have export terminals at the port with the barging on the Columbia River.
and you're a service feeder port to the Port of Portland for those activities. So strategically, we think we're located in the right place, and we've made some infrastructure investments in rural Oregon to try to help bring these projects to potential reality. Then I think the opportunity for our growers to benefit is going to be more of a longer-term opportunity. And so our immediate benefits, I believe, in the ethanol facilities are going to be primarily driven by the industrial base and the jobs at the local level. That's not exactly true, but because of the commodity prices that are going up. We're a corn deficit region now. We have a lot of irrigated agriculture in our region, somewhere in the tune of, I think, around 200,000 acres on the Oregon side. We import corn now from the Midwest to just meet our feedstock requirements, excluding the ethanol production. And we do that because we choose not to grow that corn, because we can buy it cheaper than we can grow it. At the same token, because of the increase uptick in the commodity prices, we're getting farmers now that are seriously stepping up, and I think they're going to start growing up some commodity for these projects. And that's exciting to me, because our goal is to try to create economic diversity in the areas we serve and do value-added capabilities for our ag industry. And so I think it's starting to, you know, pull together and make that happen. And so as you identify your biofuels legislation that we're here today to testify in support of, I think it's the right step in the right direction, and we're excited about that. One question I would have is a timing issue as it relates to your proposed implementation of the ethanol. The facility that's under construction at the port will be completed and ready to go in June of this year. And so they're hoping to be in production and delivering product in July. I think you've got to have a 90 million gallon threshold before your blends kicks in. It'd be nice to see that stepped in sooner so that this facility could take advantage of the legislation we're talking about here today. And I appreciate your consideration of that as you proceed with this possibility.
Thank you. We've heard that concern from several other people that we appreciate. And I just want to make sure that folks understand what he's talking about. There's a production sort of trigger in the bill, and part of that was to make sure we had the feedstock in state before we are importing from other areas, and obviously they'll be able to meet that sooner than was in the bill. So I think we'll be looking at that very carefully. So I appreciate you bringing that up here. So thank you so much. We'll move on, and then we'll have time for questions at the end. We'll go over to Mr. Rouse. Thank you.
Jeff Rouse, Carson Oil Company, Portland. First of all, I'd just like to kind of open up with a kind of where we're at right now in the biofuels without any mandates. I'd also like to just say for the record that Carson Oil Company, we're a neutral company as far as this bill is concerned. We feel we have some invested interest in this bill, so to have one way or the other is kind of skewed. So
I was going to say that's a refreshing comment, so we appreciate that.
We realize that we would benefit from this bill, but we're committed to a program whether there's a bill or not.
That's
kind of the bottom line. We've been looking at the biofuels industry for about the last 4 years, we had some concerns as the state's largest distributor of diesel fuel in Oregon. We have now seven branches across Oregon in every region of the state. So we understand the difficulties in each individual, from Central Oregon to the coast to the gorge, everywhere. So one of the our biggest concerns is you can grow all the canola you want, you can grow whatever you want, you can build as many plants as you want, but if you don't have that infrastructure put in place, how does the consumer get the product? And that's been our big concern going through this. And we're approaching 200 million gallons of diesel that we distribute out of our company. If you have problems with quality, that can really affect a company of our size. So we've really went much slower into this than others have. We entered into the biodiesel business in Portland and in Oregon in June of last year. From June to the close of business of 06, we sold 1.4 million gallons of B99 in the state of Oregon. We did export a little bit of that to Canada to meet some needs up there. We supplied some local suppliers, some local producers as well with that amount. So when you look at the state production of, or the state use of biodiesel, I think you're going to see somewhere around 2.5 million gallons for Oregon. With that said, that's a very sizable market just from the beginning. And as we begin to work with Randy Leonard on the city ordinance, and we saw that, okay, we have two choices as a petroleum company. We can either stand back and see what happens, or we can take some risk and we can kind of dive into it. And if it does go the way we thought it might go, then we're ready for it. That kind of put us, some thought we maybe were driving it or proposing it, the city ordinance, but really we were just doing what we had to do as a business, and that's to plan for the future. With that said, in the sake of time, I'll move into the infrastructure part. There's always niche markets, but that's not a market we fill. We fill, we supply some of the state's largest businesses. We did a pilot program with Les Schwab over out of Prineville. We supply TriMet in Portland with all their bus fuel in bios. But in order to take those kind of volumes, we felt we needed to put some kind of infrastructure together. So what we did is we launched out a program that at quite some risk to us if the biodiesel usage does not go forward in Oregon, over 5 years we'll spend $4.5 million in terminal infrastructure. We have signed an agreement with Valero Terminals in St. Helens Road on in Portland for what will be the Western United States' largest blending rack west of the Mississippi River. It will have a capacity of 750,000 gallons of B100 storage and have an access of over, I think it's 56 million barrels of diesel fuel that gets distributed into the Oregon market. So those all 56 million barrels of diesel fuel can be blended with this biodiesel. What this would allow is basically we've taken out biodiesel being different than a petroleum product. This rack, you pull up into the rack just like you would load diesel. You put a code into a box no matter what products you buy. And we've done the same system. You just plug in a four-digit code, and those codes will represent different blends. And the rack is capable of doing a total of 40 blends, 20 being of an on-road product, 20 being of an off-road product. And with that system, we've also put an additive injection system to handle winter issues, and also we've seen some summer issues that can some stuff that's kind of coming to light after 5-6 years in the industry. We feel with doing that infrastructure that we could single-handedly supply the state's use of diesel fuel. That's never going to happen. But to that end, we wanted to put in infrastructure in that we could never grow out of. And I think it's important to know that there's a lot of competition between base stocks. Our company is an Oregon company. All the management are all graduates of the University of Oregon. We've been around here forever.
Congratulations.
I guess I could have been bad.
I'm a brewer, I'm neutral.
He just hired a graduate of the University of Oregon State, though.
Oh, great.
Nice save.
Stop the war. Thank you.
We've, on the quality side of things, we kind of had to go out there and look and say, to deliver mass, large volumes of fuel, how can we do this? And we couldn't do it with local base stocks. We have had local production of 1.2 million. That doesn't do it for us. And so we had to go to the evil soy camp and we pulled in, but we selected a company called Renewable Energy Group, West Central Soy. They've been in the industry for 10 years. They're a farmers co-op. They understand the needs of farmers, and they're very sensitive to farmers. They have in production, by the time any of these, by the time the Portland mandate kicks in June, they'll have 165 million gallons of biodiesel production. They represent over 45% of the nation's supply of biodiesel. We're also the factory fill for Daimler Chrysler, John Deere, and many other OEMs. So we're not talking about a product that just came around yesterday. We have a 160 rail cars dedicated to Carson Oil to supply any kind of ordinances that would be applied so that we have the ability to move this product. They're all dedicated cars, and they're all actually brand new cars. That is a investment our supplier has put into that. With that said, we realize the need of Oregon-based products coming in to be made out of biodiesel. It is scheduled for 2008. We're in the process of siting, and we are looking at two different properties, one in Portland, one in St. Helens, Port of St. Helens area. And we're going to be with Renewable Energy Group siting a 60 million gallon biodiesel plant on the river for the purpose of supplying Oregon and Northwest need as well as exports to California. That is, we are a BQ9000. If any of you guys are aware of that certification, it's a certification that the biodiesel uses. It's kind of like the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval. All our plant is operated under ISO 9000 program. We have our own testing and procedures that we've put into place that far exceed ASTM 6751. I've written a set of proposed testing for the city of Portland. We strongly believe in this testing of this fuel. We have, through our supplier, I have a lot of direct experience with the Minnesota deal. I also included the test that Minnesota now requires for their biodiesel in the proposal. You know, we know it is possible to have a high-quality biodiesel in this market, and today we have high-quality biodiesel in this market. The fear is with any kind of ordinance or mandate or anything like that, that there will be people that are looking for an economic, you know, opportunity, and if people have to buy it, then obviously there is a market. So I think the testing is really to safeguard the state and the city from others that might come into the market, not the people that are currently producing in the state. So I would really like to see something very substantial and probably something that would be something for the whole nation to look at. I do know in a couple weeks we're meeting at the National Biodiesel Board in San Antonio. I know there's some proposed testing that's going to be going into that they want into the ASTM to tighten up things. We know that the specifications are a little too loose right now and they need to be tightened up, and I think I think with some of the things I've proposed and others, I think you could come up with something you could craft that would protect the state of Oregon. My last final thing is on feedstock. Like I said, we plan to source local feedstocks for it. There's enough soybeans in the Midwest to supply soybean manufacturing facilities in the Midwest. They don't need to be shipped out here. The REG realizes this. It was never part of their business plan to bring out soybeans unless they just could not find sources here. One of the things I see missing from the feedstock is Northwest animal tallow. Animal tallow is a product that could compete against the palm in price-wise, and it's something that we look at the industry. When you're talking about selling fuel on an open market to people that are traveling through our state from other states that may have fueling options outside our state, we can't put ourselves to have this most expensive base stock of biodiesel and blend it into our product where we basically outprice ourselves to that transit coming into our state. And the way you kind of accomplish and make kind of everybody happy is I think that we could take the canola that's being produced and blend it with, like, let's say, a cost-cutting product like animal tallow that is also a regional crop, that is not being used right now, and you can actually take the and lower the price of the base stock down to compete with that of soybeans, but yet still have the performance better than soybeans. So I think there's other options out there that could be looked at. I also would like to see on the trigger, as a business, we have an issue with, one of the issues was in there was a trigger with waste grease. And we understand that that's a very good use for waste grease, but not as a trigger. I think the idea here is for the Oregon farmers to be growing crops that we make into biodiesel. And if the trigger takes effect based on the 10 million gallons of estimated waste oil that's in Oregon and Washington, 6 million of it being in Oregon, I would hate to see a trigger happen just on waste grease. And then the farmers would be competing against the waste grease. So that's one issue that we'd like to see. And you know, everything else I think you guys have outlined, you know, I think Oregon will do their best to create stocks to make biodiesel out of. I think the Northwest is emerging to be the leader in the biofuels industry as far as usage. There's room for everybody. I don't think we could grow enough crops in the state to outpace the appetite for biodiesel. So I don't really think that's a real base stock issue. I think everything should, it seems to me that things have kind of gotten away from biodiesel and the benefits of biodiesel and what it does for our community and what it does for economic development. It's gotten into an agricultural thing about which feedstock are we going to use. And I think we kind of need to come back to why do we even start this conversation in the first place, and that was, you know, in PAD 5, which we were a part of, it's estimated 25% of all, of the crude that comes in is of the Middle East type crude. And with some of the ordinance mandates are put forward, you know, can't say that that's where that'll come from, but you can take a huge chunk out of that. So that's, you know, I know we don't have much time. I mean, there's tons. Last thing I will say that I'm under a non-disclosure agreement on some technology that just has just emerged. I've seen the spreadsheets and the white papers on it yesterday. I've seen the actual testing. It's by one of the world's largest additive suppliers. It came out of the UK through their operations they have here. It's been tested on soy, canola, rapeseed, used cooking oil. But for the purposes of our industry that we're involved with right now, we can take B99 or B100, add this additive to it, and make minus 30 biodiesel, which is unheard of.
Fahrenheit.
And that those papers, they're at the end of the copyright process right now. Those papers should be made available in the next 2 weeks, and it's going to be industry changing for the biodiesel. We will not be talking about 4-point this time next year.
Great, thank you so much for your testimony. Really appreciate it. And now, Mr. Dougherty.
Madam Chair, Chair Barnhart, Brian Dougherty. I'm a partner with the Miller Nash Law Firm and here representing Western States Petroleum Association. I think I might be the fifth or sixth attorney associated with this, but I'm the only one who hasn't been from Stoll Reeves so far.
Hold it against you.
Dougherty, we like competition.
Yes. And, in fact, I have to disclose that Representative McPherson's wife works with me at Miller Nash, so they are everywhere. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association on this bill, and much of this bill we like. I think you've heard Mr. Rouse talk about this, and I want to say something. Contrary to about the six times I've heard Commissioner Leonard say that only people that lose is big oil, we are getting the blending credit for every gallon of ethanol that's blended. We get the blending credit for every gallon of biodiesel that's blended. We're the number one blenders of these biofuels in the world. In 2006, WISPA companies blended nearly 5 billion gallons of biofuels. WISPA understands and supports renewable fuels as part of the nation's energy mix. One of the things we look at is try to talk about this, and I'm going to talk about the four Ps. It's public policy, it's prescriptive mandates, it's preemption, and it's proposed amendments that I want to talk about. First of all, public policy. If we look at bills like this affecting our industry, we try and look at that issue of public policy. Is it sound public policy? One thing we don't argue with, and I think you'll find very few companies that are like us, we don't challenge a state gas tax increase. We have not done so. We think that's a public policy the legislature makes a decision on. Similar here on biofuels. We support biofuels so long as they are developed through market mechanisms. It is market mechanism that has kept gasoline as the lowest price household product in America that you can name. And it's that competition and that thing. It's not mandates. It's competition. I want to talk a little bit about some of the prior testimony. One of the things we talked about was the governor's renewable energy work group. Well, we weren't invited to be a part of that. And I think that is a serious failing in these groups, is not to include the folks that have to implement this, Mr. Rouse's company and mine. Nevertheless, they had a biofuel subcommittee. At first, we weren't invited on that. But the biofuel subcommittee, about halfway through last year, invited the oil industry in, and we worked with them, despite our opposition to mandates. We worked with them to make this bill as it is in most all the sections. What happened out of that biofuel subcommittee is something you haven't heard yet. They did not come up with a recommendation for mandates. They could not reach a consensus. That was the one thing in this bill they couldn't reach a consensus. So they sent a bill up to the Renewable Energy Work Group without a mandate, and they sent up some mandate language. The Renewable Energy Work Group, of which we were not invited to testify, did put a mandate in it, and you have it today. Similar with the City of Portland's mandate. I think, quoting Commissioner Leonard correctly, we couldn't let big oil into this because they were going to kill this bill, so they spent 8 months developing a ordinance that we didn't have any input in and we didn't know about until 2 weeks before it was being passed. We have objected to the mandate. I put it on the record, and we are working right now with their implementation work group to try and meet the needs of this mandate in Portland. I want to commend Commissioner Leonard on the work he's doing with the Northwest Oregon Pendleton grain growers. That, I think, is a sensible way to try and get into this fledgling biodiesel industry, using his city fleet vehicles, working with Oregon farmers to develop a biodiesel program with his city fleets. We have no problem with that. That makes sense. We have a problem with mandating this. And I'll tell you what I feel about this. In my packet, I have something in there called 8 Reasons Why Mandates Are Unnecessary. Some of you may think they look familiar. They look a lot like what I have for House Bill 3481. Well, they are consistent today as they are 2 years ago. And one of the things they're saying is, in 2005, House Bill 3481 did not die because of a mandate. This body, the Senate, and the governor's office had decided that mandates were not necessary and they would go forward without it. It was issues unrelated to biofuels that killed House Bill 3481. We do support the use of alternative and renewable fuels, including biofuels, provided that the use of these fuels are guided by principles of sound science, technical feasibility, and cost effectiveness. And I'll tell you examples of where that didn't happen, including our own industry, and why that's a concern to us. But let's look at what we've done. From 2000 to 2005, U.S. oil and natural gas companies invested approximately $98 billion nationwide in emerging energy technologies, including frontier hydrocarbons such as shale and tar sands, solar, hydrogen, ethanol, and other renewable fuels. That's 73% of the total investment by U.S. government and private business in renewables in the nation. We need a broad mix of fuel supplies. We're here to tell you that we think renewables are a part of this, and we're looking forward to doing it. So don't confuse our concerns with mandates with a concern about the biofuel industry. We are, as I said, blending more of it than any country in the world. There are unintended consequences of a mandate that I want you to think about. I think this is a public policy decision that you all are wrestling with, and I hope you will think about it in this time. We accepted a national renewable fuel mandate. There were standards there. This national standard is far preferable to having an individual state-by-state program and much more favorable than an individual city mandate. The federal mandate was also designed to provide the company significant flexibility in meeting those standards, and I can tell you about that. It was basically a standard of blending so many gallons per year, not a percentage per gallon. I'll talk about that later. Why do the proponents of this mandate need a mandate? I think we all know why they want it. I want you to think about that. I mean, if I was asking you to mandate something, I think you'd ask me to prove why you need it. I'll first talk about ethanol. Ethanol, is it necessary in Oregon? Have you heard anybody testifying today that they're going to start growing corn because of this decision. We don't have a Northwest feedstock trigger point in your RFS for ethanol, which is where I think cellulosic ethanol would come from. You've heard a lot of farmers up here talking about it, and almost exclusively they're talking about biodiesel crops. Canola is a biodiesel crop, not an ethanol crop. As I said before, we've blended nearly 5 billion gallons of ethanol in the United States, despite a national mandate for biofuels of only 4 billion. That's a larger than a rounding error here. We've blended 25% more than we had to under the national mandate. That should tell you that we're not just fighting a mandate, or that we're actively involved in this where it makes sense. The amount of ethanol being produced now has increased 35% in the last year, and we're over 40% of the gasoline sold in the United States now has a blend of ethanol in it. One of the things I remember, Representative Kropp waving this article from API saying when corn, more corn equals lower gas prices. I liked it so much I introduced it in my packet of information for you. What that tells you is you talk about volatility of gas, the price of ethanol went down $2.50 between August and November, leading us to these types of numbers that you're talking about. The other reason that you have such a big end, you have 111 ethanol refineries in action today. You're going to have another 60 to 70 online between 2007 and 2008. There's a huge amount being blended right now, and we're using it. Why? We can take the blending tax credit and the price is right, and that's allowing a market economy to make it work. A mandate doesn't do that. Why should an ethanol mandate concern you as legislators? After all, it sounds like a good idea. I don't know how Mr. Kropp could stand here and tell you what the price of anything will be, less or more. I am certainly not going to tell you what the price of ethanol, biodiesel, or gasoline will be 3 months, 3 years, 30 days from now. One of the things I don't get is if you look at it, it's the need to be cost-effective and competitive that has kept gasoline prices down. It's the lack of competition and lack of efficiency that a mandate brings that causes that problem. Why are you encouraged to be more efficient and cost-effective if you know I have to buy it no matter what? That's what a mandate says. No matter what the price, no matter where, you've got to get it, you've got to deliver it 24/7, no matter what. And it takes away the market issues that make it a competitive product. Is corn the answer? For Oregon, I don't think so. I think cellulosic corn is, and I think we'll talk later about some of the amendments. Let's talk about biodiesel. Biodiesel is a fledgling industry. Ethanol isn't. Biodiesel, my comment is, I think we ought to walk before we run. You've heard all the conversation about gelling. That was the Minnesota problem. I want to tell you one of our experiences in oxygenates. What really happened for ethanol industry was they started mandating in certain cities in the U.S. that you use oxygenates. There were two competitors, MTBE and ethanol. And what did our companies do? We went out there because we could produce MTB right out of the oil production process. Without enough science, without enough understanding, we had to get into this market. We were able to compete with it, and we found out it gets into groundwater very quickly. And most states now have banned it. In fact, you'll see the MTB and additive bans in here. We not only support that, we wrote that legislation to put in here. And I have an amendment to even make it lower than it is now. But that was a case in which we jumped in without enough science. California electric vehicle was the same thing. They jumped in and said, we're going to mandate electric vehicles. You haven't heard anything about that in a long time. It didn't work. If they don't work, customers won't get it. That's my concern. We are moving from batch biodiesel to a very big biodiesel program very quickly. I appreciate the triggers that are in there now, but I think the city mandate says you're just going to do it July 1, 2007. That does bring me to the preemption issue. And I appreciate Commissioner Leonard's concern and his efforts in this area. I think having individual boutique fuel islands around cities is the wrong way to do it. It's not just about Portland. What happens when Ashland and then Lincoln City and then Bend all and Pendleton develop their own ideas of what they want? This is not the same as yours. It does not have Northwest triggers. It says you're going to sell B5 July 107. With not anything else. We're starting with a B2 blend based on some production issues. It makes no sense in terms of the system that we're using. You can't try and blend all to everybody else's standards and have this operate efficiently. Right now, our companies are making a decision. You heard the Commissioner Leonard say that we're all going to be ready to go July 1. I suggest that's not the case. and that what's happening is there's a cost-benefit analysis being made by the individual terminals right now to decide if to fuel those stations, some of whom may only have 8 or 9 stations in the city of Portland that they're trying to service. And the investment in infrastructure for biodiesel particularly is extremely expensive. Can they get a cost-benefit analysis? If they can't, they simply are not going to sell diesel in the city of Portland. Exactly what you don't want when you introduce a new commodity. It loses the competitive nature of what you want. Fewer competitors. Mr. Rouse would be fine if a lot of our terminals didn't produce this. But fewer competitors does not lead to lower gas prices. It is likely to lead to higher prices. Think about what Nordstrom's in charge of, Meijer and Frank and Saks disappeared. It's a simple fact. You want to have it. We support as many biodiesel and ethanol refineries and production facilities as you can get. We think it's great. It's great for Oregon. It's great for us. It creates a commodity that is being competitively marketed.
Mr. Derry, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up because we are quickly running out of time. I want to make sure there's time for questions. I mean, we have one other panel.
I'll be glad to.
Thank you.
If you look at page 5, fuel additives section, I have one change, a minor change, but it moves the MTBE level down from 5/10 to 15/100, which put it in line with California and Arizona. It's a lower threshold level. Biofuel feedstock amendment. You use the word sources. Well, I think you should refer to feedstock. I think everybody's testified that's what you meant by the word sources, but I think you ought to either put biomass grown or feedstock sources. The last thing is the renewable fuel standards. While we disagree with the mandate, I've listed here 6 items that I think this renewable fuel standards lacks and could be improved upon. And I'll be very quick with these. I pulled this down from a list of 23. So I want to tell you that we're willing to work with you in a work group. I hope we could do that to address some of these issues. I still oppose mandates, but some of the key ones, I think, is that you should look at providing a percentage of biofuels per period rather than a B5 mandate. That gives us more flexibility to say in the year, if you tell us that 5% of our diesel is biodiesel, you reach the same amount as if you tell us we have a B5 mandate. So it's going to that percentage of biofuels rather than mandate. Number 2 is just to designate an appropriate in-state feedstock and fuel triggers for both ethanol. I mean, if you're trying to do it for biodiesel, you should do it there. We've all talked about the enforcement provisions. We're very high on that. Let's get clear enforcement provisions. Let's require DEQ to do testing to make sure we don't backslide in our environmental areas. And have the Department of Agriculture commit the resources. I think they're looking at that right now. But they do fuel quality testing now, and we need to have that kind of testing to go forward. And finally, allow adequate lead time once a trigger is made. We've been telling the city of Portland that 18 months is about the time we need to get the required engineering, contracting, siting, permitting, and construction necessary to deliver on these triggers, particularly biodiesel. Ethanol we've been blending for quite a while. We need time to get those in. 60 days or whatever, 90 days is simply inadequate. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I apologize that we're running out of time, so I'm going to ask for any questions. We'll have another panel, and then we will have time for more testimony on Monday. So if there is anybody who absolutely cannot be here on Monday that has signed up, please come and let actually Ian know so we could try to fit you in. But otherwise, we have about some people have signed up, and we would ask that you can come back on Monday so we can hear more testimony. I know Representative Burley has a question, and so does Representative Cannon, and then we'll go over to this side.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony today. A couple quick questions, if I may. First of all, Mr. Rouse, as a distributor, I'm very interested in your comments on whether or not there might be a problem implementing different standards throughout the state if we were to have Portland, Bend, Eugene with different standards. And also, the other question I'm interested in hearing from the panel is, does the zone pricing policies today apply to diesel fuel? And in the future, would it apply to biodiesel and ethanol blends?
On the second one, I'm not aware of any zone pricing on diesel. Zone pricing has actually been pretty much done away on the gas side as well. I don't see there being any implications that, as far as multiple different blends per municipality, state, like that, I'd have to ask you right now in the state, on the ethanol side, something we're doing today is you have a 7.8% blend of oxygenated fuel and unleaded, and you have a 10%. Has that caused any problems? Absolutely not. It's simple as a code. I put in 1, 2, 3, 4, or I put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, whatever. It is. It's that simple. It's fully automated in these racks. We currently, of the five majors that reside in the Wheelbridge area, national companies, of those three of them, we have a principal agreement put together that would allow them to have access to branded blended biodiesel products for any of these mandates.
Okay, thank you.
Could I address that, please? One of the examples, we have 47 different blends or 54 different blends of gasoline in the United States right now. It's ridiculous. When Detroit gets a shortage, they can't go to Chicago to get there because Chicago has their own blend standards. To get to your point, what happens when a truck pulls up a 10,000-gallon tanker truck and he's going to deliver three service stations in Portland and four service stations outside of Portland? You've got a B5 blend here and a B2 blend from the rest of the state. And someone says now that Eugene has something different, so we have to do that. You cannot send biodiesel or ethanol down the pipelines. You have to blend them at the terminals. We have Eugene terminals. But again, you have different people doing different markets. Why do that? Why create that level? It would be better. We have a national mandate right now that's going to be accelerated greatly. If you want one, a state mandate makes a lot more sense than individual local city mandates that you have to meet in different blends. You may be able to push the button, but you can't change it in that 10,000 gallons if you have split service stations.
Thank you. Any other questions?
That was Representative Burley essentially asked my question. I'm sort of scratching my head here still because, Mr. Doherty, you testified that creating these boutique fuel blends will cause a significant disruption in the fuel supply system. We have a fuel supplier and distributor here who says it's as easy as pressing buttons. I understand the 10,000-gallon truck can be filled with only one blend. You can't change it after it gets in that. But it seems to me that we either have something to work out here, there's something I'm not understanding, or that one of you is correct and the other isn't. So I'll just leave it at that. I think you've probably explained as far as you can, but okay. I'm
Representative
a bit
Smith.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Gary, good seeing you. Welcome to the Capitol. Colleagues, if you haven't had an opportunity to tour the port tomorrow, take the time to do it, because I'll tell you what, you'll see one heck of a facility that Gary's put together over 15 years through blood, sweat, and tears, and it's pretty impressive. Gary, obviously legislation's about to move forward, and all the eyes of the state are soon going to be focused on you and the Port of Morrow because you're providing the infrastructure for many of these facilities that are going to be meeting this mandate. Colleagues, that's just a reality. Where the Port of Morrow is centrally located for where these facilities are coming. And quite often in this building, we throw out unfunded mandates. And I want to ask you, Gary, what should the state of Oregon be doing to help the Port of Morrow to meet the needs of these companies who are going to be meeting the needs of the state that we're about to mandate? What can we do to help you?
Oh, boy. Well, Chair, Representative Smith, Energy Committee, I guess, you know, the thing that I always advocate for is make it easy for business to do business, because it's not. And you need to make sure that any actions you might take don't layer on more processes and conditions that makes it complicated to do business and create jobs in the state. And I guess that's just a general statement. But I do have to tell you that it's easy to have these unintended consequences when you pass legislation. I know my industries that I work with that are trying to locate believe that they need that extra help to take these projects in our state, and I think that's very important to consider. I want to see that investment in Oregon. I don't want to see that investment across the river or in other locations, and I guess that's my message about, maybe it's a tax benefit issue. It's an enticement as opposed to a mandate component of this issue. And I do have to editorialize, and I forgot to do this earlier. Water's everything in Eastern Oregon, and I'd like to see you consider that as you move forward with any kind of legislation that relates to helping the ag industry or any kind of diversity in this state. We need that help. So I just want to plead with you on that. So I had to throw that in.
Okay. Thank you. And I really appreciate you being here, all gentlemen. We're going to move on to the last panel. And if there are any additional questions, I will ask if you can hang out so folks can follow up with you. Thank you very much. So we're going to do a little triage here because there are people that still want to testify. As I mentioned, we're going to have the first hour of our hearing for the House Energy and Environment Committee. We'll consider this bill again on Monday morning, and some people are here that cannot come back on Monday, so we're going to call them up now. Kevin, can you come back on Monday? Or okay, so you're okay. So we have Holly Sears with us. Let's see. And Mike, do we need to have both of you speak, or we'll just have to ask you maybe to be really brief? And Mike Leichner, we have a whole bunch of people from Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. Yeah, so if only one of you can speak possibly, we just won't have time. We have a couple of other people that want to make sure and talk before 3 o'clock. So maybe if you can summarize and
sure,
that would be great.
Chair Dingfelder, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. For the record, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. And instead of going through my spiel, I'd just like to introduce one of our members, Mike Leichner, who is the owner of Pride Disposal Company up in Sherwood. And he's here today to talk about his experience using biodiesel in his truck fleet and equipment.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. And thank you, Chair Barnhart. Basically, we started using biodiesel about 6-7 months ago, and we started looking at that for a while of alternative fuels. We were looking at hybrids for our service vehicles. We run about 30 garbage trucks and truck and trailers, so we burn about 250,000 gallons a year of diesel. And so we were looking at two reasons. One is for the right thing to do as far as the environment, and the second thing we were looking at is, can we cut back enough of our petroleum-based diesel in order to make an impact in either local or national or international impacts for the right thing to do there. The biodiesel, we started out experimenting with it. We ended up with a B20 in our truck fleet and a B99 mix in our material recovery facility and transfer station, all the equipment in there. We had some issues when the weather turned cold with it, so we cut it back to a B5, and now we're back up to, I think, a B20 in the trucks and a B50 in the equipment in the transfer station. So we're learning on a learning curve on this, but we're committed to using the material.
Great. And I think that we have the mechanic supervisor Booker Negley and operations manager Barry Graham from Pride Disposal as well. If you have any questions about their accessibility to the fuel or how it's working in the trucks, they'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. And are there any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, Holly, I don't know if we had any rendering operations in the state of Oregon, whether they might likely be members of your organization or not. If they wouldn't be, please excuse the question, but the lack of rendering operations in my district, which I suspect is no different than any other agricultural district, is cause of very, very great concern among agricultural circles. Both the lack of the service as well as the cost, the subsequent cost. We heard earlier testimony that animal tallow has the potential for a significant boost in biofuels. And I'm just wondering here, again, if you would have any cause to know whether there might be some kind of natural synergy here between a need for rendering operations and the potential for tallow to be an additional source of biofuels.
Representative Wood, I do believe that the Farm Bureau would be best to address that, so I can maybe have them come up or talk to you afterwards, because they actually, I think, would be the best people to address that.
Yes, I think so. Our Chair Dingfelder, Representative Witt, I know that our executive director is on a work group to discuss that issue, and I can get back to you on that, but I do think the Farm Bureau would be.
And I know I saw Katie Fast here, so I'm hoping she'll stick around and can answer that question.
Thank you very much, Chair Dingfelder and Holly. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Great. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Is Katie Fast still in the room? Because I was hoping she might be able to pop.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll have her come up. I'm going to call up, actually we have a professor from OSU, Chemical Engineering Department, Professor David Hackelman, who can't be here on Monday, and Jody Weiser from Tax Fairness. And then Katie, if you can come up and just mention quickly about tallow and how this could fit in, and just for the record, and then we'll close with that.
You want me to go now?
Thank you. Yes.
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The rendering issue in the state, which deals with, it's not a fun issue I'm going to talk about, but it's disposable of dead animals and also animal fat waste that's in our food supply coming from fryers and so forth. We've had a situation where we've lost two rendering plants in the state just in the past few months, and this is a worry of the animal livestock industry on how we're going to dispose of these animals from now on. The cost is going up because of transportation. These rendering facilities used to be in our rural areas. Now we're having to be serviced out of Portland and California to pick up at the dairies and other livestock places. This also impacts county and city governments when they're trying to dispose of dead animals on the roads. Our members are growing concerned about animals also being dumped in rural areas and on public lands. So, finding an avenue for the rendered product in animal tallow and putting that in biofuels is a great potential. And I would urge the committee, as you're looking at amendments on this bill, to take the comments that you've heard from Carson Oil today and add animal tallow as one of the feedstocks that you could receive the producer a tax credit on.
Thank you. We will definitely talk to the Department of Agriculture about that after this meeting. Thank you. And Jody, why don't you come up? Committee members, we do not have there is no hearing coming in here right afterwards, so those who could stay a few minutes to listen to the folks who unfortunately cannot come back on Monday, I'd really appreciate it. So thank you so much, Kate. I really appreciate coming up. And Professor, I really want to thank you for coming, and just for the record, I am a Bruin. I attended UCLA, so I am supportive of both of all of our major universities in the state and our community colleges, but I don't get involved in the OSU U of O. I'm a Bruin, so welcome.
Thank you very much. I don't really have much of an allegiance to any one university as well. And actually, I kind of consider myself a platypus, which is a branch between Oregon State and the University of Oregon.
Good for you.
Okay, so I'm going to be very quick. I've given you three pages, and obviously we have very little time.
Right. So if you can sum, that would be your key points.
I will sum up very quickly. First of all, I've lived in Oregon. I was born here. I've lived from Lakeview to Astoria and from Brookings to LaGrange. So I've been around the state quite a bit of it, and I am honored to be invited by the committee to say a few words. First of all, clearly, existence proof shows us that we in Oregon can produce and consume biofuels. No question about it. There's also clear evidence that we as a civilization indeed do infect our environment, and in particular our climate, through our consumption of additive carbon-emitting fuels. And it's indisputable by any rational and well-informed individual. That said, the question might come to you, does Oregon matter in the grand scheme of things? Because we're a state over here. But if you take a small globe model, you can see that you can still see Oregon. Oregon has a significant land mass, and what we do here is going to matter. Can Oregon grow, harvest, manufacture, distribute, and utilize biofuels, or will we merely leave this responsibility to others? I think that's the question we're asking here. Shall we keep the status quo, where Oregon is a net importer of practically all of its fuel needs, or shall we develop innovative means through entrepreneurs, inventors, and pioneers? By the way, some of those pioneers are farmers, as you might notice. So the question is, this is what House Bill 2210 targets.
Its elements are aimed at enabling the legislature with their insight and vision to empower our state through incentives and encourage the development of both the biofuels industry and utilization of its products. So the trouble is, this is a change. It's a change from what we've done in the past to what we will be doing in the future. And to initiate a change, you need to take some steps that are going to encourage that change to take place. You all know that, and you, of course, have volunteered your services to this state. With that said, it is Oregon's decision to make and your leadership opportunity. Are we willing to encourage the development of biofuels industry and in that manner create the necessity that will spawn innovations, or are we going to let it happen somewhere else? Because no matter what happens, it's going to happen. Just one final note. Somebody said something about algae a little bit earlier. So here, what if one could create an algae, and if those algae were capable of water purification and treatment at landfills and municipal wastewater facilities, and at the same time they could produce oils that could be used to make biofuels? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, actually, there are Oregon corporations that are working on that right now. And algae as one source has quite a bit more capability of producing oil per unit volume and area than other crops. But it's just one of many things that we should do together to find a way to wean us from this resource that we mine and expel to the atmosphere that's not there currently. And that is our challenge, is to find a way to change from emitting and adding carbon to our environment and increasing and changing climate to a way that we can beneficially save our society, our planet, and our civilization for the future. So that's your challenge. Thanks very much. If you have questions about this, I'm happy to try to answer them for you.
Great. Thank you so much, Professor. We appreciate you being here and for sharing your comments. Ms. Weiser, thank you for persevering. We apologize for running out of time. Somebody has to close your meeting, by the way.
Vice Chair, meeting will close.
Just want to make sure we're doing everything by the books. So I apologize that we've run over, but as you can see, there's a lot of passion about this issue, and I wanted to make sure that folks got to share their testimony with us. So thank you for being here.
My name is Jody Weiser. Thank you, Madam Chairman and committees. We asked to speak today not because we could be here on Monday, but because we're talking about revenue issues rather than the wonderful parts of this bill. And certainly clean energy, energy independence are important and things that we really like. But there are two fatal flaws to the bill as we see it. The first is that usually when we talk about new legislation like fully funding Head Start or adding to the state troopers, we know what our program costs are going to be. And while we know that there's great returns on investment that we can't count really well or we're not going to see for a long time, we have a plan for how to pay for the immediate cost. This bill has unknown costs and no plan to pay for them. And so those two are really large flaws, because what are we not going to pay for when we pay for them? We do want to jump start biofuels and ethanol production and consumption, and we can easily imagine the benefits, but we have no plan to pay for them, and we have little idea of what these costs will be. According to this bill, it looks to me like Warren Buffett and four of his friends, or Warren Buffett and 14 of his friends, could each ask for $10 million in tax credit. The differences to our budget are significant, and we need to know what we're going to spend before we start spending it. In addition, they could be hiring people who would, in fact, add additional cost to the state's needs, because they may need affordable housing, they may need child care or Head Start, they may need public health services, and they may need earned income tax credits. There's nothing in the bill that says the jobs are going to pay for the needs of the employees. And if we're going to give out state tax credits, we need to be able to assure that we're going to do something about having jobs that will support the people who are carrying them. There are provisions like that in the bills for five-year uses of economic development zones, and I think we could put those kind of provisions into this bill and strengthen it significantly in that way. So we suggest that you have a working group that would work on three things: making sure that the jobs that come with this bill are not Walmartized jobs, working at building in more accountability provisions. We know that tax credits, according to the IRS, are cheated on about 30% of the time, but the bill provides nothing to provide for more enforcement. And obviously more enforcement would be needed, not just for the scientific side of things, but also for the tax side of things. People are much more likely to cheat on a tax credit than on a deduction. And all the expenses that you're talking about providing tax credits for are also deductible items. So you have to look at both sides. And finally, you really need to identify what your funding source is going to be. We have to have a balanced state budget, not just this year, but into the future. And this bill mandates expenses from our state for the next 7 biennium without saying how we're going to pay for it. That's just an awfully big barrier to set in the way of public education, public health, and other things that we might want to do. Perhaps a working group could decide we would increase gas taxes, or we'd have sale of greenhouse credits, or we would get rid of other tax credits in order to pay for this. But there has to be a mechanism that covers it. It's a lovely bill. But if you can't pay for it, all the tax credits in it, and you can't cover enforcement, and you can't make sure that the jobs that are created are really livable wage jobs benefits, then you're really not going where you want to go. Mandates will do much of what you want to have happen. You've had many people testify before you who say this business is already happening in Oregon without any more tax credits than currently exist, and the federal government is very likely to pour a pile, like $30 billion, into new tax credits very soon because they're shifting, it looks like, all the money that goes to big oil into renewables. So it may be that you need to stand with mandates unless you can figure out a way to pay for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this last panel?
Not just a question, really, Madam Chair.
Representative McPherson?
But as a comment that Ms. Weiser has been a steadfast watchdog on the tendency in this building to give up pieces of our revenue stream more readily than we give up appropriations. And it is a discipline that we appreciate her exercising on the public's behalf.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. We appreciate you staying and appreciate you sharing your comments. And with that, we will close the public hearing of House Bill 2210. And just a reminder that we will continue testimony next Monday in the House Energy and Environment Committee.